Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, the effort to get Fresno to go on a road diet. The city adopted an ambitious plan to make Fresno streets more bike and pedestrian friendly, but not everyone is ready to trade their car for a bike. And First Five, a Fresno County judge ruled that the state could not take $1 billion of the commission's funding. What does that mean for Valley programs? Plus, Stories of Service, Volume 2, we talk to the author. But first, last year, the Fresno City Council adopted the Bicycle, Pedestrian, and Trails Master Plan with the goal of increasing the number of people who bike for work or pleasure. Joining us to discuss the issue is Scott Mosier, Assistant Director of Public Works for the City of Fresno, and Byron Watkins with iBike Fresno, the iBike Fresno campaign. Also joining us from Bakersfield is Bob Smith, founder and president of Bike Fresno. Thank you all for joining us today to discuss this issue.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you for having us this morning.
Yeah.
You know, first, I would like to start with you, Mr. Mosier, and kind of just talk about the plan itself, the master plan itself, when it comes to making Fresno a more bike and pedestrian friendly city.
Thank you. Again, as you mentioned, last year our Fresno City Council and the Planning Commission both unanimously adopted the Bicycle and Pedestrian Master Plan for bike lanes and trails. And it is a plan that looks not only at the next few years, but really the next 25 to 30 years and build out of the city. We have in mind the Complete Streets Act that was adopted by the state of California that really seeks to address all users of the road, not only single passenger autos, but bicycles, pedestrians, transit, all users of the facility. So what we look at is what's the best way to use the width of the streets that's there, optimizing safety and mobility for all users.
When it comes to bike lanes, how do we rate compared to other cities right now before this plan?
I would say historically the city of Fresno rated somewhat poorly in that the historic planning for the city was really focused on the automobile. However, the city in the last year has made great strides. In fact, between 2009 and 2010, we added 30 new miles of bike lanes, and that was the most in the nation outside of New York City. And it enabled the city of Fresno to actually receive from the American League of Cyclists the bicycle-friendly community designation, and it got us a bronze-level award. That's something we're very proud of.
Byron, I noticed, this is just my own personal opinion, that we do have a growing bike community here in Fresno.
Definitely. I think iBike Fresno is sort of working to promote bikes positively. It's just a campaign, really, to kind of keep bikes top of mind and show people that they can use their bike more. I think since the campaign started, since people have started seeing more infrastructure going in, I definitely see more bikes on the road. I think it's not as much as people think, but it's definitely grown. The big thing for moving people to bikes is infrastructure, and the more infrastructure we build, the more people will move to bikes as they feel safer.
And I noticed that we have certain parts of the city that they do have more bike lanes than other. Is it just in the newer areas where we've experienced growth, and as they build out, they include that in the whole plan itself?
Absolutely. With the new areas, really everything that's been built since about the early 90s has included bike lanes or has room for bike lanes on those streets. And we find in the newer areas where we have facilities, example, an extensive network of trails in both Clovis, our sister city, and in Fresno, as well as bike lanes in the new areas. We have been able to implement a number of road diets in areas like the downtown, the Tower District, and some in the central parts of the city.
Okay, well, first let's explain road diets for our listeners, that whole concept.
What a road diet looks at is, do we have excess capacity for the automobile? In other words, is it a road that has extremely free-flowing traffic, really a surplus of capacity that could be better used by basically resurfacing the road, in other words, repurposing it, looking at what we can do for safety. For example, a number of the streets that have been done, both in Clovis and Fresno, have been four-lane undivided collectors, a collector being not the prominent arterial that connects to the freeways, but the streets in between. And it's changed that four-lane street, undivided with just a double yellow stripe, into one lane each way with a center turn lane for added safety and then bike lanes in between the through travel lane and the parking.
Well, you know, some people would say, oh, my, you're narrowing a street that already has traffic. But I know you brought in some photos, and I know people at home can't see it. But when you look at it, the street actually looks wider.
After
you put in the bike lanes.
And it does. It does a number of very positive things. One thing is that if we've all driven four-lane streets that do not have a center turn lane. And what happens there is if you have to make that left turn mid-block, then you're having to stop in that through travel lane. So there are a number of accidents that occur in that situation from a vehicle being rear-ended. So getting that left turn movement out of the through lane into the center of the road actually reduces the amount of friction on the street. It enables good traffic flow. The other thing that the bike lanes do, in addition to providing better safety for the cyclist, it actually gets that through lane more distance away from the parked cars and from the driveway. So it does give a feeling of improved safety, better visibility.
I live on the Gettysburg Collector, and there's no road diet there now. An incident that I've had, I turn into my neighborhood there all the time. Actually, not just a rear end, but a gentleman who tried to avoid a rear end actually turned into oncoming traffic into my lane, and I had to swerve at the last second. I almost had a head-on collision. So things like this, a two-way left turn lane can help prevent these types of accidents.
Okay, let's ask our listeners, too, or for those of you out there listening to us today, I'd like to know, what has been your experience biking through the streets of either Fresno or Bakersfield? You can call us at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989 or online at kbpr.org. And right now, I'd also like to bring in Mr. Bob Smith. I understand you all are also adopting or are working on a master plan for Bakersfield when it comes to biking.
Yeah, we just are getting started. Actually, it's the Kern County, so it's in the unincorporated areas that the plan is being worked on. And the city is also looking at getting started on their bike master plan very soon.
When you hear Mr. Mosier talk about road diets, how do you think something like that would work in Kern County?
Well, we've done that on certain streets in Bakersfield already, even without the master plan. It's something that's used all over the nation when you have more capacity than what you have traffic on streets, and streets are for people, not just for cars, and so we can move more people, really, if we make way for bikes. It's kind of the way we look at it.
And here in Fresno, how many areas have you put in or use the road diet plan? Where are you in that process?
We've implemented a number of road diets. Some of the ones we're really proud of are Divisadero in the downtown west of the hospital, both Van Ness, Fulton, and Washon connecting the Tower District to downtown, and then a number of others that people readily don't think of as road diets. But if we talked about putting four lanes there, I think there would be somewhat of an uprising over that. For example, Gettysburg has the same width as Audubon Drive between Knees Avenue and Friant Road in northwest Fresno. That has always been a three-lane collector configuration where we have a center turn lane, one lane each way, the bike lanes, and we preserve on-street parking. And it's really quite good for the community. Another couple that I'd want to mention. One is one that we implemented about 10 years ago, was near Clovis West on Millbrook Avenue between Neese and Teague. And there was actually a major accident involving a student, and the city of Fresno was asked, what can we do to improve safety? And we converted that four-lane undivided collector into – we did a road diet on that. And so that was very good. City of Clovis has had recent success as well with Peach Avenue near the Buchanan area. Again, lots of concern before it went in, and a lot of people in that area have been very pleasantly surprised at the outcome, improved safety, and a much better accommodation for cyclists.
Go ahead.
I mean, I think one of the benefits of the road diet is a lot of people don't realize how many of their trips are so short. 40% of your trips are within 2 miles of your house, and 50% are within 3 miles of your house. And so I think there's that element where the grocery store is very close, Rite Aid's, you know, the pharmacy's all very close to most people's homes. And so the idea that you could choose your bicycle to take short trips, save on gas, get some exercise, all of these types of small things, as those infrastructures are put into these collector streets that allow the neighborhoods and people to feel safe to take those trips, you know, I think it's only a good thing.
But, you know, when you take a look at, first of all, if we kind of take a look at the Valley, I mean, we are all aware of the statistics that we faced here. That we have a high obesity rate, we have bad air, we have people suffering certain chronic illnesses, and things that really could be helped by some exercise. And so when you think about that, if you look at it that way, it seems like it would be, you know, something good or a good idea for just the city itself or the Valley to kind of embrace.
I mean, I think people really want to be able to get from A to B as safe and quick as possible. And when there's not bike lanes and you have to take a lane or you're riding along parked cars, people who aren't used to bicycling a lot really don't feel safe in those environments. A lot of people would say, well, why don't you just ride on the sidewalk? And while it's not technically illegal in California to ride on the sidewalk, it's definitely it is illegal in some areas. It's actually not safe to ride on the sidewalk. Cars, you're not really in cars' line of sight. If you think about when you are leaving or exiting a parking lot and you pull up to leave, you would actually – most cars stop at the road, not at the sidewalk. So the idea that they're not paying attention for you as a bicyclist. But being in a bike lane actually puts you out in a driver's field of vision. As they look out to see where they're going to pull out, they can see a bicycle pulling up. And so this actually our steps – bike lanes actually help make cyclists more visible and allows people to feel safer to take these trips and start using their bicycle more, or at least considering that as a form of transportation.
I'd also want to add one other safety aspect that we're really, really emphasizing and encouraging is that for the pedestrians crossing the street – we've seen accidents and experienced accidents on four-lane roads wherein one vehicle does stop for the pedestrian and then the second vehicle either comes around in the other lane or swerves around and then chooses not to stop. And so for the pedestrian, there's also added safety by bringing that traffic into the single lane.
And for our listeners out there, we'll pose another question. You've heard Byron talk about being safe while out cycling. How are you yourself when you're out driving? If you're a cyclist, are you aware of the cars? If you're in the car, are you aware of the person on the bike? So how do we make it safe for cars and bikes to be on the same road here? Your comments at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989 or online at kbpr.org. Now, we do have to say that not every community is embracing this. The communities that oppose it, what has been some of their reasoning?
Some of the big reasoning has been a concern about that peak 15 minutes of the day. And that peak 15 minutes might be the school drop-off time. For example, on Gettysburg Avenue, we have Thomas Elementary that's right there. And the concern has been, well, we need to be able to handle all the traffic that would come and drop off kids within a five to 10 minute period. Well, you know, I grew up riding my bike to school and walking to school. But today, a lot of parents choose against that. They choose not to. And why is that? They choose, well, we have very busy streets, fast amount of traffic, and don't have the infrastructure in place that encourages cycling and walking to school. Or it's that everyone wants to be able to get to work right at 8 o'clock and leave 10 minutes prior to.
Let's, Jerry from Fresno, your view on, you know, how we can make it safe for both cars and bikes to be on the same road.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I bicycle a lot in Fresno, and I'm very pleased with the way the bicycle lanes have been added on Van Ness and the Visadero and places like that, because those are areas where I bicycle. And it used to be much more difficult in those areas because at one time coming on Van Ness, before there was a bicycle lane, I had to stay quite close to the parked cars, and a parked car opened the car door right in front of me, and I very nearly had a collision with the car because of that. It's much safer now for the cyclists. And I also drive that area, and when I drive that area, it doesn't bother me that there's the number of lanes has been reduced by one, because the traffic is light there anyway, even during the rush hour. So I think this is a good move, this the road diet plan.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your call, Jerry.
Okay, thank you.
One of the neighborhoods that I am aware of where people do oppose one of the streets, a road diet for one of the streets, is on Fresno Street in West Fresno.
District 3
between, I think it is, from Fresno Street from 99 to
California.
To California. Yeah. And their reasoning being, from what I have read, I'm not speaking for them, this is just from what I've read, that it was the whole idea of they thought that that Fresno Street, there was going to be the volume of traffic on Fresno Street was going to grow more. And basically, one of the comments was just, you know, we don't need them. I mean, it's a older neighborhood, they said, and with a lot of seniors.
Well, projections on that road, I mean, the city does projections on roads to sort of see what the count is. A road diet, really, the sort of the base consideration is about 20,000 cars a day. If it's more than that right now, they're not really going to look at restriping it as a road diet. Anything less than that would be considered. I believe that section of road in District 3 is only about 6,000 to 7,000 cars a day, if that, from what I had heard. But their projection was by 2030, they felt they would hit between 16,000 and 18,000 cars on that road. So even by 2030, it was still going to be below the projection of what a road diet would accommodate. I think the challenge is it's really an education process. A road diet almost sounds like a negative thing. The word diet kind of comes off negatively. The idea of bike lanes, people don't necessarily connect the idea that as a driver, I could also use the bike lane. That infrastructure is available to me. I think it's infrastructure that's really available to everyone. At the end of the day, a bike lane and a road diet provides citizens a choice to how they want to get around the city. I think for people who can't afford a car, who have to take their bicycle, people whose car breaks down, these types of infrastructure improvements really make it available to everyone to choose exactly how they want to get from point A to point B. And that section of road, I think, I really think it's just a benefit everywhere. And I think it's just that mental tick of saying, I'm going from one lane, from two lanes to one lane, and we can't keep selling it that way. You have to kind of explain the full benefit of the piece and how it incorporates.
It would make a great biking area for anybody who's driven that. Could part of it, you mentioned, being education, perhaps to a group of people who don't bike that much? And you see that in some of the lower income areas, you don't see as many bike lanes. And it could be because they're already established neighborhoods. And another part is safety. Do you think some people are just concerned about, you know, being out?
I'm sure it has a lot to do with it. I think the challenge is obviously we're dealing with I almost don't blame the drivers who are upset about it. It's like you kind of blame 50s infrastructure planning in a way. I think you have to – people are so used to what's there and you think, okay, well, this is changing. It's going to be worse. But really, as a as a local representative or politician, I really think the big thing is them really being in support of these things. I feel like representatives that care about the safety of their neighborhoods and constituents really need to be pushing for these types of things, because there's been people are putting in road diets in cities all over the country. It's proven that it makes the road safer. And we really need the representatives to be educating their constituents to say, look, this is going to work for you, not kind of being indifferent to it. And I think that's a challenge, is if the representative's indifferent to it, then there's no reason for the constituents to buy into it, because if the representative doesn't see it as a positive for his constituents, why should the constituents buy into that?
Okay, we have Karina. Karina, you have a comment about bike lanes?
Yes, thank you for having me. So I live very close to the college. I live right across the street from the football field. Now, I do agree that bike lanes are very important, especially where I live. There's lots of students that bike to school, which I think is absolutely great. But I also think that if we're going to start doing more bike lanes, more of the street diets, I think that we need to start educating those bikers, those pedestrians that will use the streets, because a lot of them don't realize that they still need to follow the laws of the road. And so I've almost like hit multiple students that are not paying attention or are not following the laws of the road.
Okay, thank you, Karina. That is one thing. People who do ride, there are laws that they have to adhere to, and maybe some may not be aware of them. They can get ticketed.
You can get ticketed. I think it's definitely at that point. We're talking about kind of two things. You're talking about infrastructure improvements, which is going to increase bicycleship, but then we're really talking about education and enforcement. It comes down to, now that there's bike lanes, like, how do we start educating people how to use them? I mean, when there wasn't infrastructure before, it was kind of a free-for-all, you know. Obviously, bikes that ride on the sidewalks treat the way they cross the street differently. So, like, I know, like, if I was to ride on the sidewalk, I would see myself more as a pedestrian, the idea that a lot of pedestrians will walk a red light. But as I move and my bike out more to the street in a bike lane, I treat the way that I approach lights differently, and that really comes down to an education process. And then plus the enforcement. You're going to start to see police officers being encouraged to ticket more for violations like this.
Bob, there in Kern County, I know you all are just starting the process, but are you facing much opposition?
No, not really at this point. And I think that, like Scott said, it's education is part of the process, as you let everybody know. Actually, the bicycle infrastructure in Bakersfield is better in some ways and worse in some ways than Fresno. We have a wonderful bike path that kind of diagonals through town that is accessible for a lot of people. But most of our bike lanes are on the high-speed arterials, which is similar to Fresno in the newer areas. And the idea of getting bike lanes on the collectors and the slower streets where people feel more comfortable and they have a bike lane and they have a space there, I think will encourage bicycling a lot more. But no, we haven't got any far enough along, I guess, to have pushback from the community, and we're still actually in the educating the representative stage, as Scott was saying.
But this is something a lot of cities are embracing. That's what we're talking about. A lot of communities are embracing for a variety of reasons.
Absolutely. I mean, all across the country, all across the world, I mean, bicycling is in the future, and it's not a fad. It's a trend. And, you know, to have a future with 20 to 30% of all the vehicles on the road being bicycles is very doable and reasonable and good for the community in, like you say, many ways, health and environment and economics.
Okay. Thanks, Bob. We have Allison. You have a comment about bike lanes.
Well, I love them. My entire family bicycles. And my husband rides to work from Bullardon West down to Maple and North 3 days a week.
Wow.
So he uses the ones on Van Ness frequently and says that the anxiety release is huge, because you don't have to worry about being somebody's hood ornament anymore.
What do you think it'll take to maybe get more people out biking, Allison?
Well, a little bit of it is happening all the time. I mean, all you have to do is look around. On any given day over the last 5 years, I see 4 or 5 times more people who you can tell are cycling commuters. It takes a commitment, but the bike lanes are huge. I cycle, but to be honest, I get nervous of the cars, so I end up riding out at Woodward Park and on areas where there are less traffic and big, wide bike lanes, because you do get nervous when you're riding alone. I think there needs to be more cycling education. Certainly, you see a lot of people that, for example, ride the wrong way in the bike lanes, you know, and that makes it dangerous for everybody. But I think as things progress, it seems to be something that happens ever, you know, all the time. And I think the more bike lanes and the safer they are, that encourages it, because I think, as your commentator was saying earlier, as a parent, my son, when he was going to school, I drove him every day because the traffic was just too scary to send an 8 or 9 year old out on a bike. If you have wider, safer bike lanes, I think that certainly makes a difference. I know in New York City, some of them even have a concrete divider, and I don't think that would go over really big in Fresno.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call, Allison. We really appreciate it.
But I have, you know, as I said, we appreciate the ones on Venice hugely, and I don't, as I said, I don't worry about my husband riding home, especially once it gets dark, quite as much as I used to.
Okay. It's a good thing.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Where are we, Scott, in this whole master plan that we have? How does it lay out? Is it over so many years that we're hoping to do this?
Really, we're looking to do this over what we'd call the build-out of the general plan. And the general plan is what guides new growth and development in the city of Fresno. Right now to 2025, and we're in a process of lots of community engagement on a 2035 general plan. So some elements of the master plan include things like new trails in the new growth areas, or these brand new streets where right now it's nothing more than a two-lane country road. And what is it being built to? The transportation planning of the city 20 years ago would have said four-lane road, very wide, high capacity, and then we find out it's not really needed to that degree. So we have a number of road diets and conversions that are proposed in the plan, and as those streets come up for resurfacing and maintenance, then that's when they're being evaluated project by project.
And when you were doing this, there was a lot of public input in this process, wasn't there in the beginning?
Absolutely. We, as far as the master plan was concerned, there were a number of workshops and community outreach at high schools all over the city, as well as downtown and City Hall. And they were scheduled in the evening to be convenient for people to come. And I was encouraged at what great turnout occurred for this. It seems to us very much so that it's a strong interest of the community. As gentlemen, some people know, named Mark Kepler, likes to point out, when Measure C, the transportation sales tax, was reenacted, a survey was done, and out of all the concerns and issues, number three on the list were trails from a standpoint of biking and walking and a desire to do that. Again, we're talking about bike lanes today, but very similar. That's a very strong interest to the community.
Do you think maybe some of those areas right now that are kind of on the fence are opposing it, do you think that they will come around?
You know, you hope. I think the education process is important to that. I think that education and the realization that isn't going to affect the street as much. I think we really need to look at the streets properly too. You have a residential street, which is the street you pull out in your neighborhood. You have a collector street, which essentially gets you to the arterial, so that's what you pull out of your neighborhood into, and then you have arterial streets. You know, there's not a big plan to mess with the arterial streets. It's really with the collectors. And so when you think about it, those are really community streets. They're streets that allow people to get in and out of their neighborhood. The Gettysburg proposed road diet actually has 5 schools within the space of that road diet, and there are 4 parks. So the idea that there's going to be safer routes to school around those schools on Gettysburg is huge. So I think it's really important. One thing just really to add on when you were asking about the general plan going forward, I think it's really common and easy for people to call their rep and complain about something. But the people that support the bike lanes, I mean, it's not common to think like, oh, I should call my rep and say, I really enjoy this bike lane that I have outside my house. The people that support the bike lanes, I really encourage you to contact your reps and let them know that you do enjoy the new infrastructure. Let them know that what they're putting in is positive for your family and your kids. I think that's really important.
How do you think this could impact the future of Fresno? If we're able to develop this master plan out the way it was intended?
A few thoughts on my end from a city perspective. Number one, obviously, we have air quality issues in the valley, and cycling as an alternate mode of transportation has to be part of that in order to shift traffic from being single passenger auto users into things like bike lanes or also transit. Another aspect of it is a lot of studies have been done that show a really strong correlation between better economics and cycling and that type of infrastructure in the community. And it just seems example after example of communities who have embraced cycling and providing that safety have seen their economics improve.
I think there, if you'd like to be involved, there's the Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Committee, the BPAC. They actually meet this Thursday downtown, and anyone's invited, and that's where they talk about new projects. And so, like, if you're a citizen who really wants to start getting involved with that, going to BPAC meetings, they meet once a month on the – is it the first Thursday or the second Thursday?
It is the fourth Thursday.
The fourth Thursday of the month. So getting involved there, it would be great. And I'm with Scott. I think as you look at the cities, creating more livable cities, people want to live in places that they have these options available to them. And the cities that are on the top of the most livable cities in the country have huge biking infrastructure. And that only brings more business to town, different people, and that's only going to grow the city positively.
Bob, and one last question for you. What do you think maybe you can kind of take from where we are in Fresno when it comes to pushing your plan along?
Well, we learn a lot of things, you know, but I guess one of the big things that's unique to the valley is the bike paths on canals that was in your plan, and your canals are open and already have access that people can jog or bike down if they have mountain bikes and stuff. And in Bakersfield, we fence our canals off, and so we don't have that access. And I think that's something that needs to be looked at as we move forward with our plan. And again, I think it's great for the whole community, and they mentioned the environment and economics, and it's also health. I mean, the whole valley has obesity problems, and, you know, the automobile is a great tool, but it doesn't have to always be the only tool for transportation, all those short trips and get out and have some fun every day. I think it's important.
Okay. Well, thank you. Scott Mosier, Assistant Director of Public Works, City of Fresno. Byron Watkins, iBike Fresno, the iBike Fresno campaign. And Bob Smith, founder and president, Bike Bakersfield. Thank you all for joining us this morning for the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. In November, a Fresno County judge ruled that the state could not take $1 billion from First Five California and use it to help pay down the state's debt. First Five was established in 1998 when voters approved Proposition 10, a 50-cent tax on tobacco products. The money is going to improve the education, health, and well-being of children. Here to discuss the issue with us is Kendra Rogers, Executive Director, First Five Fresno County.
Good
Thanks
morning.
For coming in, Kendra.
Thanks for having me.
What does the ruling mean? I mean, do you get your funding back or you're still waiting?
No, what the ruling is that it ruled AB 99 invalid. So AB 99 was the bill that was passed authorizing the $1 billion takeaway. And so that was the basis of our lawsuit, was whether or not that bill was valid or not based on the Prop 10 legislation guidelines. So what it did is it essentially, as of today, that bill is invalid. And that means that the funds stay here in Fresno County's trust fund.
Now, how much funding are we talking about for the Fresno County area?
So for Fresno County alone, it was about $17 million.
What did that mean when you thought that your funding, that amount of money was in jeopardy? Had you already gone through the process of cutting programs, or did you just put everything on hold?
It was kind of a combination. For us, we're a county that does not carry a reserve. So every year we budget every penny that we have. You know, there's so many needs in our community. And at the end of the day, you know, we're just the stewards of these funds for our kids. These funds belong out on the streets serving them. So for us, because of that, we didn't have just an account we could pull that money from. So our commission chose to file the suit and postpone any cuts until we knew the outcome of the suit, because it would mean for us cutting programs that were already operating. And with all the other cuts from the state and county levels, our community just couldn't sustain that.
You know, the budget isn't going to get the budget isn't going to get any better anytime soon. So does it make it difficult? Are you concerned that, you know, they'll try to come back again to get that pot of money?
It wouldn't be a surprise. You know, since Prop 10 was passed in 1998, we've been on the ballot two other times. Just recently in 2009, through Proposition 1D, where the legislature tried to take 50% of the funding over a five-year period, it passed with close to 67%, or it did not pass, I'm sorry. It was 67% no vote in saying, no, we want this funding to stay local. So with this, we're not going to be surprised if it's challenged again. We're hoping that our elected leaders will look at this opinion. It was a pretty strongly worded opinion in terms of the purpose and intent of Prop 10 funds in local communities, and respect that. But, of course, we're still vulnerable.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think they keep coming after the first $5?
I can't say exactly, because I don't know what their exact thoughts are, but our kind of theories behind it are that at the end of the day, kids don't vote. And so this is a dedicated funding stream for kids. You know, this is not general fund revenue, and that's a common kind of misconception. This is tobacco revenue that was designated specifically for kids, and kids don't vote. So it's hard for kids to hold our elected leaders accountable when they take their funding. So it's not just First Five funding. If you look at funding for kids across the board, it tends to be the first thing that's hit. And at the end of the day, it's because our kids can't hold them accountable.
How important has First Five and its programs become, you think? I think before there was a First Five, kids did so much without. And I don't think that when people kind of think about just how far you've come, you know, and the kind of programs you've put in place.
Right.
The idea of where we were before, especially with all the cuts to education.
Right. You know, it's interesting, because before we came on the scene back in 2000 here in our community, early childhood was not something that was talked about regularly. When people talked education, it started at kindergarten. It was K-12. Before that, it was really, you know, kids weren't discussed. And so I think one of the biggest pieces that Prop 10 has brought to the table in the First Five world is we've raised awareness about the critical importance of the first 5 years and how that really sets the stage for all of the development that occurs over a child's lifetime. And a lot of people don't know that. I mean, the most dramatic brain growth happens really before the age of three, but during those first 5 years. So for us, in our community, we fund a lot of programs that without our support would be gone. But it's not just programs we're funding. First Fives play the unique role of being a change agent. We've been able to work with institutions to actually change the systems that are already there for kids to make them better. So it's really taking a comprehensive look at that. And when you look at what kids need to know today when they start kindergarten, my daughter is in kindergarten this year. And even though I felt she was prepared
for you,
I mean, if they're not on the first day of school, if they don't know all their letters, if they can't write their name, if they're not able to identify all their numbers, they're already behind.
No, kindergarten is so different today than mm-hmm. it was when we were in school. And I think part of that is the fact that there have been so many studies that yeah. show that what kids learn in those first five, those developing mm-hmm. years is so important. Mm-hmm. And that's why they've sort of changed kindergarten. Not only that, when you look at the rest of education, where they expect our kids yeah. to be by a certain stage. And, you know, you can talk to a lot of teachers and they will tell you, they can see the difference in a kid who went to preschool
right.
and a kid who did not when they come into kindergarten. And I don't think people realize just how important that is.
Right. And one of the things with First Five is this is not a poverty program. This funding was intended for all children in Fresno County. So this isn't just for children, you know, that are low income or at risk. This is for kids to support every child in this county, every parent, you know, with a young child, in making sure that our kids are ready for school and that they're ready to really reach their full potential. So it gives us an opportunity, a unique opportunity as a community to use these resources in a way that we identify. You know, it's not dictated by the state. Our decisions are made here locally based on the local, you know, our local needs.
And so it was just not First Five Fresno County, but a lot of the First Five commissions throughout the Central Valley kind of joined together in this lawsuit.
Right. So the initial filing was here in Fresno by our commission, Merced First Five and Madera First Five. So we were the first counties to file. We filed a joint suit, and then Orange County filed later that same day. And then after that, Marin County joined in, Solano and Sonoma, and then down south it was L.A., Riverside, and San Diego. So there was 10 counties total that filed suit, and the cases were consolidated here in our Fresno Superior Court.
And again, they were going to take out $1 billion out of the program?
Correct. And really at the core of this was voter rights. You know, even if people don't agree with First Five and what we're about, the voters have spoken. And they were asked this question again just recently there in 2009, and they said no. And the legislature really violated the will of the voters. So at the heart of this case is really that voter rights piece.
Now, with this vote, how will you be able to move forward with the programs that you already have?
Well, of course, the state has 60 days to appeal, so we're definitely waiting until that period closes before we make any major decisions in terms of how we'll move forward. But, you know, it certainly looks hopeful for our funded partners out in the community who rely on these resources to be able to support the families and the kids that they do. So we're starting our next strategic planning process, and we're excited that we at least have a verdict and can really plan appropriately now for our resources.
But that's got to be difficult, because when you talk about what people have to understand, there are a lot of other people that kind of depend on this. I mean, you talk about your partners, and for them to constantly to have to, you know,
right.
exist in limbo has got to be difficult.
It's very difficult. And, you know, the other piece to this funding is creating jobs in our local community. I would say probably about 90% of the funding is going to salaries out there in the community, community-based organizations, in school districts, you know, out through faith-based organizations. So this isn't just serving kids and families. It's helped supporting our local economy by creating jobs. I mean, our funding alone creates a couple hundred jobs every year that are supported through this funding. So it's, you know, there's a lot of implications to this being taken and put up in the state general fund.
Right. And not only that, if that were to happen, you know, we don't have any programs to replace it. There would not be any programs to replace it, because so many programs, I think people out there may not be aware, but for young children from health to education have all suffered budget cuts.
They have. And what's really most concerning about that is the need is greater than it's ever been. You know, we have families that have never been unemployed. You know, they've never been facing home foreclosure. So there's a lot of new families that are kind of entering this world of needing support for their kids that are just learning how to navigate this system. And a lot of these services aren't going to be there.
And some of the services you provide is not just preschool or early childhood
right.
education, You also provide other services.
We do. We do everything from birth to preschool entry. So we have a big policy initiative around breastfeeding, where we're trying to increase the rates of exclusive breastfeeding in our community. We have incredibly low rates, and knowing that it's a prevention of obesity and asthma, two things that are very high in our community, that's something that's important to us. We also fund home visitation programs. We do a lot of work with child welfare and supporting kids that are in the foster system. So we kind of do a whole gamut of
different
things.
And also health as well.
Oh, we have a big focus on health, particularly around children with special needs, making sure that issues are identified early, that kids are connected to resources and support. So we really look at kind of all of the building blocks that go towards creating a strong child.
Do you know how many children or young people that you serve?
Well, just this past year, we provided about 30,000 services, individual services. So some of those might have been like the same child receiving, say, both a health screening as well as a parent support group. But, you know, that's a lot of services being provided in this community. We serve a couple thousand children a year through our intensive services, and we reach a huge number of families, you know, in terms of our resource information and support, the basic project we do every year that provides, you know, basic need supplies and things to families in need. So we touch a huge number of families in this community.
Well, yeah, you do. I think another point we might want to kind of touch on with this is, do you think part of the reason, you know, the state might be going after your funds is this whole idea of, like you mentioned for yourself, you all don't operate with the surplus.
Right.
And there are some first fives that do. Now, it's my understanding, it may look like it's a surplus, but
right,
a lot of times it's already
not
accounted for.
Correct. In our county, we do not spend money we don't have. So when we make an award, we're awarding money we've already received from the state. So that money is sitting in the account while that program's operating, and we pay out off of that. So when they see that we have money sitting in our account, they go, oh, look, here's some money that we can take to fill the budget holes, when really that's money that's been obligated to contracts. You know, there are some first fives throughout the state that do have actual reserves, but they have plans for those, you know, just as the state's in the situation it is in now. We all knew this is a declining revenue source. So several of the commissions made the decision to really have some money in the bank so that as their revenues declined, they were able to kind of offset that and maintain a certain level of service in their communities. Our commission here felt that given the magnitude of the needs, that really we needed to put out every penny that we had every year. So that's why then when this happened and the state looks at that, it's just interesting that they are – there's always discussions at the state about creating a rainy day fund, and they try to get that approved. But yet the first fives that did that were penalized and
we're operating correctly.
Correct.
Well, you just mentioned that you were saying there is a decline in this revenue
there
source.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we at
so
one
people
point
aren't smoking as many cigarettes.
Part of it is the reduction, but they've also found other ways to get around paying the tobacco tax. So, you know, cigarettes that are bought online or that are bought out of state, you know, they're not paying that tobacco tax on them. So, you know, when we first started even up to a couple years ago, we were around $13-14 million in revenue. We're down to the revenues for this fiscal year projected at just slightly above $11 million. So, you know, that really does. And it's also derived from a formula that includes birth rate. So as with this economy, you know, birth rates have declined. So that's all of those factors together have really reduced that revenue.
So really, what's next for your first five here? You've got part of that lawsuit out of the way. You know, they can always appeal. You mentioned that.
Yeah.
But what are some of the things you're kind of working on here in Fresno County that people might want to know about?
Well, what we've really focused our attention on most recently is this policy piece. And, you know, really was you got at it, which why did we end up here to begin with? And at the end of the day, it's because our kids – they aren't able to hold them accountable. So we have partnered up with a couple other community leaders that started something called the Children's Movement. And it's a nonpartisan movement, and it's really aimed at just trying to raise the level of awareness about the importance of kids and making them a priority. It's forcing our elected leaders, our community leaders, our business leaders, or, you know, faith-based leaders to say, are we doing everything that we can as a community to make children our number one priority? And are we making decisions that really reflect their best interests? So it's a grassroots movement. It's parents, grandparents, neighbors, community members. So if listeners are interested in joining, which we would strongly encourage that, they can go to the website, which is tcmfresno.org. So they can get information about the children's movement. And that's for us, it's really the only answer right now, because we're going to continue to be under attacks. Our kids' services, even non-First Five funded services, are going to continue to decline. As you were mentioning, I mean, education, it looks so bleak. So until we as a community really say, no, our values are kind of screwed up here, and we need to rethink why we ended up here to begin with, and it's because we haven't appropriately invested in kids, you know, we're going to struggle.
Yeah. And so that's what you're doing. You're trying to go back to remind people, you know, this is why we got started in the first place. This is why we're here.
Right.
Okay. Thanks so much, Kendra, for coming in today. And good luck with that.
Thanks.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. Joining us now is Fresno author Janice Stevens. She has written a sequel to her 2007 book, Stories of Service. Valley veterans remember World War II. She's here to talk about her new book, Stories of Service, Volume 2, Valley Veterans Remember World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and the Cold War. Thanks for joining us today, Janice.
Thank you. My privilege.
Well, this is an extensive collection of stories, I mean, covering a long period, a quarter century. How many Valley veterans did you talk to for this book?
Oh, I think we probably had about 110 and ended up having to cut several in order to fit the format that we had. We wanted it to be comparable to what we had the first one out. So we had to cut a few, and we made selections this time by not including anybody that had written a story for the first book, which was World War II emphasis. And this time we ended up having to let all of those go that gave me a second story and just include the ones that were new to this piece.
How did you seek out these veterans?
Well, I have a group that meets with me. I call it a veterans class. They like to be called a group that meets with me every Monday morning, about 50, 60 people at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District, who has been hosting this now for 10 years. And that's where I compiled the stories. People hear about the group. They come out. They meet us, stories of service, and they share the stories. And I'm recruiting again for the next book three.
You're right.
It takes a long time to pull it all together.
I think it would.
Mm-hmm.
Was it difficult for some of these veterans to tell their stories?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I was a guest last night at Dr. Rice's Stories of Service that he is doing out with the journalism students at Fresno State. Tremendous honor to be invited to do that and to see that. And a lot of my veterans were out there, and one of them in particular saw me and thanked me for that opportunity to be in my group that gave him that freedom, that comfort, the empathy that he was able to open up and share his story for the first time.
I was going to say, for some of these veterans, it would probably be the first time,
because
a lot of them don't talk about what they went through when they come home.
They'll come and they'll sit there and be in our class meetings for months before all of a sudden they're ready to tell the story. And then it opens up, and they end up with something as in the permanent collection with Dr. Rice at Fresno State, or in the Valley, the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress, in my book. You know, those stories are preserved. It's history that needs to be recorded.
How do you think it differs when we talk about this kind of history? Mm-hmm. Do, number one, have people that we know, local veterans,
mm-hmm.
who are telling their stories to be put in a collection of book about their own war experience. It's got to be different than just reading, you know, a history book.
Right, absolutely. Well, I see the difference as in a history book, you're reading somebody's interpretation about history. These are personal experiences. These are the ones that are in those trenches that are the ex-POWs. This particular book has 13 stories of ex-POWs and how they were captured, how they were captured, what they experienced in captivity. You don't pick that up in a history book about it. You know, you can't make it that that startling, that chilling, that traumatic when you read about history, except for reading the personal history of that.
And some of these veterans, how did their experience really impact their lives?
So many of them just came back, picked up their lives, and carried on. They married their sweethearts and went back into the work world and had families and grandchildren and all of this. They don't see themselves as heroes. They feel they are in a room of heroes, but not them. They don't consider themselves heroes. And I think that in some ways we do have those with post-traumatic stress disorder. And in the olden days, didn't they call it shell shock for World War I and all of that? Today it's recognized, it's treated. VA hospital is doing a great job with that. And people are realizing that there's therapy that comes out of telling the story and feeling that comfort and empathy from their fellow veteran as well.
We have Mike Harris. He's the assistant director of the Legion of Valor Veterans Museum here in downtown Fresno. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Oh, very welcome. I'm glad to be here this morning.
How do you think a collection of stories like this really helps people understand veterans and the whole veteran and you know people who've served in the armed services, their whole experience?
Well, I think, you know, a book like this, you know, getting out among the populace is actually a tremendous thing. And the reason being is, you know, it's like if you're talking to an individual and you're hearing their account of a story, you know, that's a firsthand. Well, you know, then as it spread, you know, through the other folks in the vicinity or whatnot, you know, it gets a little bit diluted. But if you can get a firsthand accounting and get that published, you know, being told as it was told, I think that's a tremendous asset to preserving our history and making things, you know, understand for those, you know, future generations as just how much sacrifice these folks really went through.
And also, Janice, and both of you, when you look at the Valley and mm-hmm. our region, you know, we really do have a huge history mm-hmm. of people in this region serving in mm-hmm. the armed services. We've seen it with, you know, some of our younger veterans. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the community of Clovis and how much they've lost because we have
right,
so many young
right.
people from this area who step up to serve.
Right. Absolutely. And that would be my dream, is to be able to sit down with the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and begin to work with them to tell their stories. Valerie DePinto at Fresno City College is doing a great job with their Veterans Affairs organization and beginning to reach those young people. But we have such a community of veterans here. I don't know the number, but it's huge.
Mike, do you know what is your take on that? Why do we have so many people here who really are willing to step up and serve?
Well, I think you know, patriotism goes back to one's cultural roots. You know, we have a large number of Hispanic folks in the Valley, and you know, I think culturally they're very, very supportive of, you know, the family unit, and the family unit you know, dictates to them that you know, service to others is very important. And I think so for that particular aspect of society, they are very, very enamored with going into the military service, helping our country. We have a number of a great number of folks that you know, migrated out to the West from the Dust Bowl region, and a lot of those folks were looking for work, and the military supplied that. So I think a lot of it is, you know, you can attribute to, you know, cultural relationships as to one's roots and how they came up, how they was raised, or they were raised.
Janice, I see you shaking your head.
Yeah. I'm agreeing with that. I'm nodding. You can't see me, Mike. But I am agreeing with you that definitely, I think that's one of the great things about our Fresno area, our Valley area, is that family orientation, that unity that we have in our culture. And I think definitely it sets up patriotism.
Well, you've already written two books, Janice, so we'll be looking forward to your next one. Also, you will be at a book signing today. Mm-hmm. Isn't that correct? Right after you leave here, matter of fact, noon to 1 mm-hmm. at the Legion of Valor Veterans Museum in downtown Fresno. Isn't
That's
that correct?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, yeah, so we'll be looking forward to meeting you.
Thank you. Me too, Mike. My
well,
pleasure.
Okay. Like I said, being able, if your next book, you're able to talk to those veterans. We have so many who are going mm-hmm. to be coming home from Afghanistan
right.
and Iraq, and mm-hmm. and I'm sure they're going to have some stories to tell, mm-hmm. And now they have a person and a support system.
Right, they do. Our Fresno has a great support system for veterans.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in today, and it's a great book, Stories of Service, Volume 2, and as we mentioned, Janice is going to be at the Legion of Valor Veterans Museum today at noon. And that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.